Quaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Tuesday, October 23rd, 2012, and this is podcast number 217. Before I get into that, one of the things that I was supposed to talk about yesterday, and I ended up not even talking about it till halfway through the podcast, was the new Bad Quaker forum that's now open. And if you didn't hear the podcast yesterday, what we've done, we've been working for a while on the on a Bad Quaker forum, and you know all the interruptions with family issues and all that that have disrupted the podcast for the past couple months have slowed the progress of getting the forum up and running. It's really like a weekend project that we just stumbled around with for like 2 months. But anyway, the forum is now up and running and functional, and you can get over there, you can look it all over, you can see a good portion of the forum even without registering or anything like that. If you choose to register, it's free. You can register for free. It's really simple. You make a username and you go in and you register. And you can look around. You'll see a little bit more of the forum than the public is allowed to see. And if you so choose, there's two ways using the forum. There's two ways to support BadQuaker.com. There's one, you can become a supporting member by going into once you've made a profile, you can go into your profile. And in the settings there, you can click in and change your settings to become a supporting member. That costs only $4 a month or $25 a year, so it saves you a little bit if you get a whole year at once. And the other way you can use the forum to help support BadQuaker.com, right on the header, right in the top front center of every page, there's a series of buttons across the top, and one of them says donations. And you can just go in there and make a one-time or a repeating donation if you'd like to. And that's independent from being a supporting member. So we do appreciate that. But above and beyond, you know, actual money, you can support BadQuaker.com just by going to the forum and making a free login and just, communicating and being a part of the community, because really we all support each other. You know, money aside, we all support each other in this venture that we're in, just by talking to each other, sharing what we're going through, and you know, sometimes just sharing goofy things we find on the internet. And a forum like this is a really good way to do that. It's a good way to build a tighter community where we can all communicate and work together and kind of, you know, I've said before that steel sharpens steel. And the way that works, you know, we rub up against each other. We disagree. We agree. We learn from each other. And over the years, I've learned tons from different forums that I've been on. And that was our motivation in creating the Bad Quaker Forum. You know, sure, there's a money issue there, too, that this is a way to help pay the bills to keep Bad Quaker on the air. But, you know, we were talking about a forum, even whether or not we were going to have any money issues or not with it. Because it's so valuable to have a community like that you can get acquainted with other listeners and you can get acquainted with other people that are like-minded. And you know, you begin, like I said, iron sharpens iron or steel sharpens steel. You can begin to work with others and really learn and expand your own mind and experiences and so forth. Also, you know, it's a really handy thing. Like, for instance, my wife and I are still planning on a motorhome tour of the South, probably through the winter this year. And, ideally what I'd like to arrange is some kind of, you know, stopping points where maybe there could be get-togethers of some kind in different cities as we go through the South, maybe do a few interviews with some of the listeners, or maybe just have lunch together or something like that. And so there's a place on the forum where I've started talking about organizing something like that. So get on over. There's a, at badquaker.com, there's a button right across the top where you can, that leads to the forum, and you can just hit that, go to the forum, and make a login and jump right in there and be a part of the conversation. And one of the things that I was supposed to put up on the forum, but I haven't done yet, is my suggested reading list. And so that's one of my, that's on my list of things to do this week. So hopefully I can get that accomplished and get a suggested reading list up on the forum. And that'll be on, you know, in the side where everybody can see it, so it's not going to be hidden away or anything. But then, I don't know if I mentioned it or not, if you become a supporting member, then that act will open up more areas of the forum to you than the free side can see. And also, we have a contest going on right now, and I'm not sure exactly how many of these we had left. But as of yesterday, when the podcast posted yesterday, we were offering a free badquaker.com t-shirt to the first 10 supporting members who buy a full year of membership at badquaker.com. So I think we're down to like 6 or 7 that are left. They when that posted yesterday, a group came in pretty quickly and got a bunch of them. And then we also gave away some t-shirts over the weekend before that contest opened. We gave away some t-shirts to some of the people that were able to figure out where the forum was and get in there kind of early birds, so to speak. So if you want a badquaker.com t-shirt, that's a great way to get one. Essentially, you're getting it for free, and you're buying a year's worth of membership on the forum. So that's a pretty good way. And as I said, it's a first-come, first-served basis, and I think there's like 6 or 7 left. So or there is at the recording of this podcast, which is about 9 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday morning. And that's Eastern time. So who knows how many will be left by the time this podcast posts. Now, let me also give a tease, while I'm taking up a bunch of time here, let me also give a tease to an upcoming podcast. I interviewed Larkin Rose, and I haven't had a chance to edit it yet, and it's probably going to be posted for Friday's podcast. But you want to be sure and hear that. Larkin is a wonderful person to speak with, and just a really, he's an amazing individual. And I had a really good time talking to him in the interview that I did with him, and in the time, you know, before and after and off mic times, he and I had a really good talk. So that's really going to be worth catching. Like I said, I'm going to try to get that up on Friday. It may post earlier, it may post Wednesday or Thursday, but we kind of like to have it up on Friday, because when it goes up Friday, then it's on the LRN over the weekend, and it gets played over and over on the radio that way. So that's probably what we'll try to do, is post it on Friday so it plays all the way through the weekend. Now, I got an email from a listener in Canada, and it came through at the badquaker at badquaker.com email address. And so my wife Cindy usually takes care of that end of the emails and so forth. And she pointed out to me, she said, "Ben, you got to read this one." And so I jumped over there and read it. And wow, that just blew me away. It was really nice. The person who wrote that, you know who you are. And I really appreciate hearing. The email was talking about how this person was a kind of a right-wing leaning type person, but not really fitting into your typical right-wing type people, and slowly started coming around towards libertarianism. Read or heard, I should say, the audiobook of Michael W. Dean's A User's Guide to the Human Experience, and it really opened his eyes to some things. And through that, he eventually found the Freedom Fiends podcast, and he eventually found the Bad Quaker podcast. And he kind of told, in the email, he kind of told his progression through that. He's a truck driver in Canada, and he told his progression through this and how he was able to listen to a lot of these as he was driving. And it was a really touching email. And I really appreciate reading that email. It really, really made me feel good this morning. And I want to, you know, one of the things that was mentioned in the email was that, you know, it's so easy to have no hope when we look out and we see everything that's going on. Once our eyes are opened and we really see how big this myth is, this myth of government and this myth of the state, and once we see how intrusive government really is and how damaging it is to society, and you just can't stop looking, you can't stop seeing once all this starts to reveal itself to you. And it's really, it can be just a crushing weight upon you to realize the position that we're in and what we're headed towards. But as you start to understand, you know, the beauty of liberty and really what humans are capable of, and you start realizing that there is hope, that we are going to come out the other side of this thing, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be nasty. He talked in the email, he talks about storm clouds, gathering, and that's a really good way to look at it. And it is going to just be a storm that comes down on us that's going to be, you know, unimaginable. But without getting into without getting into all the panic and terror filled point of view some of the more sensationalists get into, the thing to concentrate is not on the battle, but it's on what's on the other side of the battle when victory takes place. That's really what we have to keep in sight. That we have to keep that victory in our mind. And we have to realize that this is all going to be worth it in the long run. I mean, we might see some really dark days. But you know, the human mind and the human abilities and the culture that humanity has developed is so much more powerful than this myth of the state. And eventually it's going to burn away. And mostly it's going to turn on itself anyway. Mostly governments of the world are going to turn on those who support governments of the world and those who depend on governments of the world. So as we see the beauty of the market and as we see the potential of humanity, and as we turn away from dependencies on governments, as this beast goes through its phases and melts itself down, if we're really careful, it's not going to be that difficult to stay clear of it. It's not going to be pretty, and it's not going to be easy, but it's going to be possible to stay clear of it. And as long as we together, all of us, can develop the unity of a community so that as this comes to us, we can be prepared for it and we can just sidestep the storm. Anyway, that email was really encouraging. I also wanted to touch something that I said yesterday. I was talking about the Archer Daniels Midland Company and other companies like that that receive lots of farm subsidies and subsidies in the ethanol production and other things like that. And in my pronunciation of Archer Daniels Midland Company, I have a tendency, you know, I've lived in Ohio for probably three different times. I've lived in Ohio, and they total probably around, I'm going to say, 18 years or so that I've lived in Ohio, and I've also lived other places too, but that 18 years in Ohio has really affected my speech. So, for some odd reason, they call Ohio and Indiana and Michigan, they call that the Midwest. It's neither mid nor it's west. It's on the Canadian border and it's in the east, but somehow, you know, this sticks with us from the 1800s when Ohio was considered the Midwest. I think if you looked at a map, Midwest should probably be Colorado or somewhere. But that's a pet peeve of mine. Sorry about that. But here in what's called the Midwest, there's this sort of a hick tendency to add unnecessary S's or to take S's away from places where they would go and put them somewhere else. So with a company like Archer Daniels Midland, you tend to start saying things like Archer Daniel Midlands or Archer's Daniel Midlands or, you know, some other variation of that. And I think I slipped into that a few times. It's kind of like the Midwest tendency to refer to Walmart as the Walmarts. Me and Bill's going to the Walmarts. you need anything, you need some fishing supplies. That's kind of the Midwest. I know that sounds a little bit more southern, but once you get into the outer culture of the Midwest, that's what you get into, sort of this redneck culture that's laying underneath the entire Midwest. And the more you get towards the cities of the Midwest, the less of that you hear, but it's there. One of the things I always have found odd, in working around the Cincinnati area, there's this tendency to pronounce, I'll say it like this. I've been in meetings where there was two or three engineers and a couple people with doctorate degrees, and my boss, who was a local. Most of these people have come into the area in the aerospace industry, and they were not locally, but my boss was locally. And so we're all in this meeting together, and maybe we're in the middle of a conference call with some people that are in, Edwards Air Force Base in California, or maybe one of the other places like that in California. And my boss would make the statement, "Well, I want to be specific about this." And there would be like this odd look that everybody would have, because there's kind of this weird Cincinnati pronunciation of specific, where the locals say Pacific. And if you're on a conference call with people in California and you've got engineers and highly educated people from a variety of places around the country, and the guy who is supposed to be the boss of all of you uses the word Pacific instead of specific, it can really get confusing when you're talking about technical items or the management of something or other or some program or whatever, and you start using words like that interchangeably, and it can get a little confusing. But that's one of the tendencies of here in the Midwest. We, just like every other area, we have oddities in our pronunciations. Now, when I was talking about the Archer Daniels Midland Company yesterday, I mentioned a study that James Bovard did for the Cato Institute. And I want to touch on that really quickly, too. James said that ADM has indirectly cost Americans tens of billions of dollars in higher prices and higher taxes. And he also said that at least 43% of Archer Daniels Midland's annual profits are from products that are heavily subsidized or protected by the American government. And he talked about how out of every $1 of profits earned by Archer Daniels Midland in the divisions of like corn sweetener operations, for every $1 that they earned in profits, it cost consumers $10. And for every $1 that they earned in their bioethanol program, for every $1, it costs taxpayers $30. That's just a stunning waste of money, where money is just handed to this massive corporation. And I've talked before about things like regulatory capture, where I've talked about it generally in reference to things like police and city governments and things. But the classic example of regulatory capture is where a corporation infiltrates aspects of government that regulate that corporation or that corporation depends on. And they funnel, either they funnel funding towards that corporation, or they adjust the regulations in a way that punish other corporations and help the one that has done the regulatory capture. And that's the case with companies like Archer Daniels Midland, or with Monsanto, or with specifically in the farming area. I mean, you could go into defense and you could talk about Boeing or some of the other companies as well. But in yesterday's podcast, I was trying to talk mostly about farming, and corn subsidies and this kind of thing. And I forgot to mention that regulatory capture was a major player in how these things take place and how they're affected. Now I'm going to break here for a commercial. And when I come back, I want to get into a little bit more about the level of waste that we're talking about and how that affects. I'm not going to really go on forever about the things I covered yesterday. I'm going to try to give a slightly different view on it. But I want to talk about how it affects other things in life and other things in the economy and other things in society. So stick with me. I'll be right back. Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress.
I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial there. And if you noticed, we have a new sponsor here at badquaker.com. Get over to badquaker.com, and you'll see the banner ad for Taran Lupo's book, and you can just click on that. It'll take you over to Amazon. And I don't think the book is available yet until the beginning of next month, but at least you can look around at Taran's other books that are available over there. And he's quite a good author. He's got several books that I've really enjoyed of his. So anyway, I was talking about, yesterday I had talked about the Archer Daniels Midland Company, and I had talked about James Bovard had done a thing where he looked just from the years 1980 to 1995 at how much money was that was just dumped into the Archer Daniels Midland, and how the cost to the taxpayers was far more than what was apparent to the average average person that looks at it. But what we're really not considering, and I mentioned this yesterday as well, we're really not considering the bloated bureaucracy that regulates, oversees, inspects, investigates, and taxes, and enforces this whole scam onto all of us. We don't see those things when we look at stuff like, and this is just the corn subsidies. This is not including, wave after wave of other things that the government involves, that it gets its tentacles into, and it just drives its claws into. So it's impossible to know how much the economy is damaged by the sheer existence of government. Since government doesn't actually produce anything, it only destroys wealth. The government can never make wealth. It can print money, but when it does so, it's just taking wealth out of the pockets of people who already possess money and puts it into the pockets of people who the government gives the new money to, which is generally the bankers that get it first. So the government can't actually create any wealth at all. All the government can ever do is either redistribute existing wealth, which it does very inefficiently, or it destroys wealth. That's the only two things that the government can do. Now, and I said yesterday that all this stuff with corn, with all the subsidies and everything, it creates artificially cheaper corn prices. But in the long run, we pay for it in lots of other ways, through increased prices of other products and through price distortions and through levels and levels of bureaucracy. So what would food costs look like in a free world? Well, or in a free market? There's really no way to know. We do know this, though. I know from gardening. I know from the time I've spent gardening. And as a young man, when I was in my teens, I worked farm labor quite a bit. And I'm confident that food prices would be very low if it weren't for the interference of the government on so many different levels. Food prices would be very, very low. Now, that doesn't mean, so we wouldn't have so many multi-million, in the case of Archer Daniels Midland, multi-billion dollar companies that are making vast fortunes in the farming industry. We wouldn't have that. But the balance would come out in the fact that the small farmer can then compete on an even level. And so you wouldn't have the advantages in the market that that the government creates to support giant, monstrous agribusiness farming. So the small farmers would have a much better hold in the market, and they would make a much better living. And so, but food prices would still be low, lower than they are now as a whole. And I talked yesterday about the cost of education, and it's really easy to see how the cost of education would be so much lower if it weren't for the government interference. And it was, what was the price of education prior to government interference? Well, you look throughout history, and in many cases, the price of higher education was free. You found a mentor, you found a teacher, you found a scholar, and you hung out with him, and maybe you spent some time with him, maybe you did some tasks to help him in his life, and you learned like that. And sometimes a scholar or a wise person of some kind would have maybe 15 or 20 or 50 people that would follow him around and learn from him for a while. That was the old method, and it wouldn't be like that now, but you think of the internet, and you think of how things like the Mises Institute and other places like that are actually making money while sharing information for free. And, once you let the market go, once you free the market, all kinds of things interchange and play into the market and lean things in one direction or another. So it's impossible to say what the cost of education would be in a free market, but we can guarantee it would be much, much cheaper than it is currently without all the levels of bureaucracy and interference that go on now. I've argued before that about 60 to 70% of all productivity of society is destroyed by governments, about 60 to 70%. And I think that might even be a conservative estimate. If you think about how much money goes to income taxes and how many taxes are hidden on things, like, you buy a car, well, there's taxes on every rubber item that's incorporated into that car. And every ounce of iron that's mined is taxed over and over and over, and as it goes through the process to become the steel that becomes the parts of the car, it's taxed numerous times through this process. And all the labor that it took to get it out of the ground and to make it into iron ore and to get it into steel and then to shape it into the shape, it's been taxed through labor over and over and over. And then there's different types, was it transported in by rail? Was it transported by highway? And so there's layers and layers of taxes that we don't see. And again, what does the government do with all those tax money? Well, it does two things. It redistributes wealth and it destroys wealth. And when it's redistributing wealth, it's discouraging because when somebody hands you money, this is what I was talking about yesterday with free money. When somebody hands you the labor, the fruits of someone else's labor, you don't appreciate it as much as the person who actually labored to produce it. So you're not as careful with that money as somebody else might be. So in the case of, free money from the government, whenever they redistribute wealth, whether that's through bureaucracies or whether that's through, corporate welfare or through individual welfare, or, it doesn't matter how the government redistributes that wealth. When they do so, they discourage the production of more wealth. And the other thing that the government does is destroy wealth. You think about all the wealth it takes to create a bomb, just one bomb. And then the government goes and drops it on somebody and kills them. Well, they killed somebody who may have a productive life and may do things. Plus, they wasted all the money of the bomb. And there's ways of looking at it, say, oh, well, if that guy hadn't been killed, he would have made a bomb of his own and he would have done this or he would have done that. But, then you're kind of starting to buy into the whole idea that You know that really super poor people in foreign countries on the other side of the world who are living in mud huts and just barely scratching out a living, somehow those people are a threat to the largest, most powerful, richest country in the world? And you know, I'm not sure I can buy that. But even if we go outside of the whole military argument, going back to what I said about 60 to 70% of productivity in society is destroyed by the government. Think about, I talked about this some time ago. You think about companies like Google and Apple. Two huge companies, Google and Apple, are now spending more on IP protection than they are on research and development. They're spending more, they're handing money to lawyers to protect false government-backed IP rights than they're spending on research and development of what the what the consumers want and how they can provide new products for consumers and how they can compete with each other honestly. They'd rather pay lawyers to sit around and grub through papers and see what loopholes in laws where they can get around things or how somebody might get around something and sue them. They're so wrapped up in trying to protect themselves from all the nonsense that government has created that that they waste money on that instead of research and development. So the government destroys existing wealth. We know that through things like, anytime you're paying somebody to be unproductive, here's a way that the government destroys wealth. You have a guy sitting in a car with a radar detection device. And you have another guy who's driving down the street to try to get to work. Now, if he can get to work on time, then he can, produce something. He can make something. He can do something that creates wealth in society. But this other guy is sitting in a car behind a sign, somewhat hidden. And as the productive guy drives by, and he's 7 miles over the speed limit, the guy with the radar jumps out with his car, chases him down, and gives him a ticket. Now, he does a couple things when he does this. First off, he stops the guy from being... Now, who was the speeder threatening? Who had the speeder harmed? The speeder hadn't harmed anybody, and the truth is that the very cop that pulled him over and gave him a ticket drives faster than that all the time, both in his regular life and as a policeman. No, I don't think anybody can logically make the argument or honestly make the argument that that speeding 7 or 10 miles over the typical posted speed limit is really all that harmful on society. Sure, if somebody's driving recklessly and they do actual harm to someone, then you have a person who's guilty of doing harm. But your typical person who's speeding, including the cops who speed regularly, politicians who speed regularly, the typical person who's speeding is not doing anything to harm anyone. And as a matter of fact, delays in commute from one place to the other, trying to get to where you can be productive in a job, those delays are unproductive. You're just wasting energy when you're driving in a car to try to get someplace. So the longer that you're at your employer, the longer that you're doing your job and doing it correctly and being productive, the more enriched all of society is. When that cop pulls you over and he talks to you for a half an hour and lectures you and intimidates you and then he gives you a ticket, all that time is unproductive for you. It's the government destroying wealth because you're not being productive producing wealth. Your employer's not being productive having you produce wealth for them. And the cop is also consuming during that entire time. All that time that the cop is dealing with you and all the time he's sitting on the side of the road waiting to give a ticket to somebody, he's also consuming wealth that whole time. And so then there's the ticket. So now you might get hit with a $150 fine or whatever it is. It's higher in some localities. And what happens with this money? Well, first off, that's money you can't put back in and buy the things that you want to buy and do the things that you want to do with it to become more productive. Maybe you might want to do something with it, like invest it in something, or you might want to, you know, maybe just buy a hamburger or whatever. It doesn't matter how you spend your money. The odds are you're going to spend it in a more productive way into society where it's going to be utilized by other people. But once it goes into the hands of government, it just goes to build government bigger and stronger to oppress more people and steal more money. So again, you have destruction of wealth on multiple levels just by a simple speeding ticket. And you echo that out across the vast reaches of government. And you see that all the government can ever do is either steal and redistribute wealth, and it does so very inefficiently, or it steals and destroys wealth. That's the only two things that government can ever, ever do. So once again, the government destroys existing wealth. It kills innovation, just like what I was talking about with Apple and with Google. And I could give 1,000 other examples, too, how the very existence of government kills innovation. And then the other thing the government does is it lies about the past. It creates a history that is entirely a lie. You know, we hear things about how all the nonsense of Lincoln worship and all the, you know, that is a horrible individual, nasty, racist, evil man. And if you listen to the government propaganda, you'd think he was a saint. You go to Washington, D.C., and there's literally a shrine there. There is literally a temple, a Zeus-like temple to worship Lincoln, with him seated on a throne in a Zeus-like fashion. If you look at the you know, the old the way that the old Greek gods were worshipped, that's exactly how, or actually that's not true. Actually, it's more like the Roman gods, the way they have him seated with fascists under each of his two exaggeratedly large hands. What message are we trying to get across with the oversized Lincoln hands? What are you trying to tell people with that? Well, you see, that's the kind of historical distortions that government does. That's how they stay in business, through the historical lies of twisting the past like that. And then if you take government out to its logical end, well, what is the ultimate government? What would the ultimate government look like? If government had its way, and you think about places where a totalitarian society exists to one extent or another, even beyond what we have in, you know, the United States and Canada and Europe and so forth, you think of countries like North Korea and Cuba, where, you know, where socialism is taken out to a far deeper extent than it is in Europe or in America. And you see in North Korea, you know, they tried desperately to create a rocket that can carry a warhead. And there are hobbyists in the Arizona desert that can make better rockets than North Korea. North Korea works with stolen technology. They use threats and extortion to get money from the U.S. and from China and from Japan. And with all the extortion, with all the threats, with everything that they do, with all the stolen technology that they depend on, and the North Koreans still can't make a rocket that can carry a payload without wobbling off and falling into the ocean somewhere or blowing up halfway off the launch pad. There was a big hoopla made a few years back when they attempted to set off a nuclear device inside of a mountain. And the problem was that you know, the tectonic measurings, the earthquake measurings that the U.S. and other countries did, indicated that from the size of the explosion that took place, the North Koreans probably failed to actually ignite the nuclear device that they... The most likely, the explosion that was detected was the igniter for the nuclear device. Most likely, the device itself did not go off. So they can't even accomplish that. With stolen money and stolen technology, they can't pull off a simple rocket that hobbyists in Arizona can do. You know, that's the result of government. You think of the Cubans, and they're down there wiring together old 1950s Chevy sedans so that they can haul their chickens to the market. There's no innovation. The bigger and the more powerful and the more intrusive government is, the less innovation in the market you see. because in so many levels the government discourages innovation in every way. Socialism in general, and really that's all government is. Government is just an aspect of socialism. And socialism in general has a tendency to stifle innovation. And if you're not sure what I'm talking about, that government itself is actually socialism. What is socialism? Socialism is central planning of the economy, central planning of the means of production. And that's exactly what government is. Even if you believe that government does things like, for instance, provide national security, if you actually believe that government does that, you still are accepting the concept of central planning of national security. And of course, there has to be taxation to provide that. So now you have central planning in the economy in order to provide taxation. And specifically, in the modern nation state, we have central banking, which is controlled by a fascist system where corporations are married in with government, both the banking industry and corporations are married in with government, and so we have socialist money control in pretty much every nation state in the world right now. And what's the alternative? Well, the greenbackers want to get rid of the different fractional reserve banks, the Federal Reserve and other banks like that. They want to get rid of them and put all money production directly into the hands of government. Like that would be better. Like pure socialism would be better, or pure, moving towards pure communism. Like that kind of socialism would be better than the fascist kind of socialism that we have now. Let's trade. The greenbacker says, let's trade. The socialism you have is not good, so here's a different socialism, and we're supposed to buy that story. And that's what we're offered. Okay, I'm going to break again, and stick with me. I'll be right back.
Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you.
Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean. Available on Amazon. Your house is
your property. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. And I should mention, you might be able to hear in the background, I've got the window open. It's a nice fall day in Ohio. We have nice springs and nice falls in Ohio. So I don't know if you can hear those birds in the background or not, but they're back there singing to me. I like to feed the birds a lot, so that's they see me at the window. I have the window open, they see me at the window, so they decide to come and sing for me. And I throw bread out, and I throw peanuts out, and other things like that. So, anyway, so that's in the background noise there, if you can hear it. I'm not sure if it's coming through on the mic or not. So then, going back to, the government's destruction of wealth. Just imagine for yourself, imagine the wealth of humanity if suddenly the myth of the state was revealed, and the economy experienced a lifting of about, let's say, 60-70%. Let's say that drain on the economy of 60-70% were suddenly lifted. Just imagine what that would be like. Not just you yourself suddenly having 60% or to 70% more of your own wealth that's taken away in so many levels by the state, by the government, I should say. But think of that as it spreads out through all of humanity. Think about all the different ways that that the economy would be boosted if we didn't have the burden of all these bureaucrats. And then there's this other hidden aspect to this. You know, I was talking about that cop who spends his afternoon sitting in a car, radaring people, trying to catch them and get them to pay the government more money. Well, what if he was? What if he didn't have the opportunity to feed off of society like that? What if he put the same amount of effort into an actual job that was productive? What if instead of feeding off of other people's labor, what if that job was not available for him and he was forced to go out and get honest work? You know, work where he actually produces something, where he either provides a service or a real product, something that people want. And now we know that the cop is not producing something that people want. Otherwise, people would pull over when they see a cop and volunteer to give him money. You see, if the cop really provided a service people wanted, people would voluntarily go and try to pay cops money. But, well, you know, I guess some people in society do that, but we call that bribery. But, yeah, so, you know, maybe cops serve that purpose in the current market that we have. But those bribes wouldn't be necessary in a free market, because activities that don't harm anybody wouldn't be against the law. So how much would be added to the economy if those people who currently feed off of society were suddenly forced to actually get real jobs and do something for a living that was productive? What would that do to society? You know, you think about it. I've talked about this before. During World War II, at the height of World War II, vast amounts of men in the working ages, in the most productive ages that they would be, you know, where they would normally be either on the farm or in factories or doing something else in society where they're producing stuff, a huge portion of those young men were taken out of the workforce. And in essence, they were, by putting them into the military and by doing all the things that they were doing in the military, they were no longer producing anything for society. They were only consuming. So you have this huge quantity of young, productive men that were taken out of society, and they were all became dependent upon society to feed them while they fought the war. And I'm talking specifically about World War II. So during that time, a massive amount of money, a massive amount of other people, older men and women that weren't in the workforce prior to this and things like this and more, and young people that were too young to go into the draft. These people went into jobs and then had to work and support those people who were in the military that were not producing anything in society. They were only feeding off of society. So then as the war progressed, the great thinkers, you know, in Washington, D.C. and other, in London and places like that, they got to thinking that, you know, wow, once this war is over, all these young men are going to go dumping back into the workforce, and it's going to destroy this. It's going to destroy the economy. Unemployment is going to go through the roof. And of course, that's false. That's based on Keynesian economics, and it's entirely flawed in its thinking. But that's, you know, they're Keynesians, and that's the way they thought. So they began scheming near the end of World War II. How can we, you know, interfere with the normal market processes? Because they were so afraid that unemployment was going to go wild and they would fall back into the Great Depression. And so they were so afraid of this that they started planning and scheming all kinds of things to do to fix the economy once all these military people became unemployed. And the good thing for the economy, the good thing for people, is that all these geniuses in Washington, D.C. and in London and so forth, they couldn't agree and actually get anything done in time. And because of that, the war ended quicker than they thought. And all these young men, these young, very active, very hungry men, were dumped back on the workforce before the governments of the world could really do anything to prepare for it. And instead of it being a terrible burden on society, instead of unemployment running rampant, those people came home and they immediately went to work doing stuff. And if they couldn't get a job, they made up a job. And so you had restaurants springing up everywhere, and you had small businesses popping up everywhere, because these guys were highly skilled, highly energetic, and highly motivated, and they wanted to come home and have a private life and do something and make a living. Well, that's what happens. You see, when you put a whole lot of extra workers into a workforce, you don't increase unemployment. As long as there's no government interferences, you don't increase unemployment. You have a greater pool of people who are highly motivated to do stuff. And when people do stuff, when people make things that other people want to buy, and when people add their labor to raw goods, then all of society is made better by this. So instead of it being a burden on society, when all of these military people came home from World War II, it was a boom to society. It was the employment went just expanded, and there was all kinds of new businesses started, and it was very productive, and the economy turned great. And these economists who had predicted this destruction, of course, they just lied their way out of it and kept their positions in government. But now you think about today, like I was talking about, that 60 to 70% of wealth that's drained away from the economy through the existence of government. And you think about all those layers of bureaucrats that are currently paid to shuffle papers and paid to dominate people and paid to just destroy wealth in all the different ways that government destroys wealth. All those people would have to get a real job and become productive or starve. And people tend to try to avoid starving, so they would have to get real productive jobs in society, or make up jobs, or create new businesses, or something. And this would be a massive boom to the economy. Just firing all the government employees alone in every nation, that one act would cause an explosion in the economy like we can't even imagine. Because these people would still have to work and eat and make a living. And so they would make up stuff to do. They would figure out things to do. And it's impossible to imagine what kind of an explosion in the economy this could create. How much depth of wealth would be created. It's just, it's staggering. But they don't want us to think about these things. They want us to concentrate on who's going to be our next tyrant in chief, who's going to the right-left nonsense. They want us to worry about, but if Obama's elected one more time, then destruction's going to come. Or if we let this, horrible right-wing extremist Romney run the government, then it's going to be terrible. And we're not supposed to really look at how much wealth the government destroys. We're not supposed to look at that. We're supposed to get all wrapped up on things like, whether or not Big Bird, whether or not PBS and NPR should exist or not. This tiny little drop in a bucket of the American government's budget. We're supposed to think that that's important. We're supposed to ignore. You just compare. Like, according to Defense Industry Daily, over $1 billion is going to go for Hellfire 2 missiles between 2011 and 2014. These are contracts that are already in existence. $1 billion just for one type of missile. And this is not even a good air-to-air missile. This is it's really old, outdated technology. If I recall, it's from the mid-70s or something like that. Well, no, the Hellfire 2, I think, is an updated version. But either way, it's an old technology. It's a very limited use thing. Of course, they're great for putting on drones and, blowing up wedding parties and funerals and things like that. Schools, they're great for blowing up schools in poor third world countries. They're really effective for that. But $1 billion just on Hellfire 2 missiles alone from 2011 to 2014. And we're supposed to think PBS and NPR and Big Bird are something that's we should focus our attention on that. The U.S. government spent about $445 million in 2012. That's 0.012% of the budget. That's less than a third of what the government wastes on Amtrak every year. And we're supposed to focus on those things. A single Nimitz-class carrier. Now, this is not the supporting vessels that go with it, not the carrier group that it's a part of, just a single Nimitz-class aircraft carrier costs about $440 million a year just to keep it floating. And the U.S. has 12 of them. It has 11 in service. One of them is in reserve. But the U.S. has 12 Nimitz-class carriers. Now, I'm going to run down a quick list for you. Here's the total functional aircraft carriers in the world, all of them combined, every functional aircraft carrier in the world. The U.S. has 11 functional and one in reserve. The U.K. has one functional carrier. France has one. Russia has one. Spain has two. Italy has two. India has one. Brazil has one. China has one functional and two under construction, and we're told we should be scared of that. And Thailand has one aircraft carrier. The United States has the same amount of aircraft carriers as all the other countries of the world combined. There's a slight difference, though. I hate to say it. This is going to sound like some kind of American pride thing. It's really not. This is just a technical fact. Other than the two new Chinese aircraft carriers that are under construction, other than those two, and those don't count in the 11 that the other countries of the world have, and since they're not actually on the water, it doesn't matter anyway. But of the 11 carriers that are not U.S. carriers in the world, most of them are junk heaps compared to the 11 Nimitz-class carriers that the U.S. floats. Those Nimitz-class carriers are amazing machines. And the U.S. has 11, and the whole rest of the world has 11. Now, why does the U.S. need 11 carrier groups? That's just the carriers. There's a fleet, practically, around each one of these carriers that functions with it. The submarines, the destroyers, all the other ships that go in a carrier group. And the U.S. has 11. And the whole rest of the world has 11. Now, who's the United States afraid of? That's really the bigger question. Who is the United States afraid of? Are we afraid that Spain, with their two carriers, are gonna present a threat to us? Are we afraid that Italy, with its two carriers, are gonna present a threat to us? Are we gonna fear China, who has never aggressed toward us in any way? Are we gonna, But we've aggressed upon China several times. Do you know about the Boxer Rebellion? Do you know about when we sent troops into China on more than one occasion? We've messed with China quite a bit over the years, but China has never aggressed towards us in any way. But yet we're supposed to be afraid of them. We're told that they're cheating in trade. Well, how do you cheat in trade? How do you do that? If a trade is voluntary between two individuals, then how is it cheating if China is providing a good or a service and we're accepting that good or service voluntarily? How is cheating? But yet on the ads on TV, we're told China is cheating in trade. You see, we're fed lies constantly, and we're fed fear, and this fear is just hyped upon us constantly in order to get us to think about how the world would collapse around us if the U.S. wasn't so dominant that we're more powerful than all the other countries in the world combined. If it wasn't like that, then we would be destroyed. Why would they come and do that to us? Why would we be afraid of a tiny little Middle Eastern country that there are individual states in America that are richer than they are? Why would we fear them so much so that we have to go and invade them? Why is that? Why do we buy this story? They want us to think about Big Bird. And in the latest, now we have this latest series of debates, and where Romney wanted us to think about training programs for workers. Yeah, like the government can train workers and that'll stimulate the economy. More education, that's what we need, right? Obama says we need to spend more on education. That's what we need, right? More money spent on education. That'll just be great, won't it? More government interference, more government destroying wealth, more government redistribution of wealth. Keep doing what's never worked before and maybe it'll work this time, right? Is that the insanity that we buy? All of us in society, not just America, Europe, not just the United States, Canada, Mexico, the people of these countries believe these lies. And why? Because we're distracted with nonsense like Big Bird? Or because we're supposed to be so afraid of some foreign enemy that we're convinced is going to come get us if we don't spend billions and billions and billions of dollars pounding them into the sand? If we don't do that, they're going to harm us? Obama's words in the latest, I think it was in the latest debate, he said, after a decade of war, I think we all recognize we've got to do some nation building here at home. Nation building here at home. Wow. Holy crap. If Obama wants to do nation building here at home, the way we've been doing nation building in places like Afghanistan and, Iraq, ooh, that's kind of scary. That's a lot scary. That's practically a declaration of war against the American people. But then again, actually, the declaration of war against the American people came when a group of really nasty statists got together in Philadelphia and decided to form a federal government to dominate the people of North America. That was a declaration of war against the people of America. Folks, for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening today.